Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That war rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and if you're wondering why I'm laughing, it's because this is our third attempt at this intro, because I keep messing it up. With me, as always, my co-host, Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you?
To be fair, Chris, the first mess up was Skype's fault, not yours, which is often what happens on this show. And I gotta actually warn everybody before we get into it, that there's a little bit of Skype trouble during our interview segment, maybe in just a couple places, but it is absolutely worth it because we have an absolutely wonderful and delightful guest on this week's episode of War Rocket Ajax, Veronica Fish, the artist currently on Archie and who has done lots of other cool stuff. We're going to be talking to her about how she got into comics and how she got into Archie specifically, the Riverdale CW series promo art that she did, Jack Kirby, so much cool stuff that we're going to be talking to her about.
It is another great interview. I'm telling you, all we do in 2016 is win with these guests. 3 for 3 in guests, 4 for 4 in great shows, and we're going into it now.
I'm looking forward to more great interviews to come. But you have a great interview to listen to on this very episode, so congrats. All of you listeners.
For a second, I thought you were congratulating me.
Well, congrats.
Yeah, Matt, I know. I was there.
Congrats all around. But before we get to the interview, Chris, we've
Everyone
got some...
Everyone, take a moment. Congratulate yourself. I'm going to do it right now. Congratulations, Chris.
Before we get to the interview, though, let's take a little while and take care of some business, Chris. First off, let's thank our newest Patreon supporters.
That's right. These are the people who need the real congratulations because they have gone to patreon.com/warrocketajax and chipped in a couple bucks every month to help keep this show coming to you, to help keep us trucking along with stuff like healthcare, and to help us pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills. Matt, who do we have to thank this week? Whose names are we going to make fun of and immediately lose that money?
First off, we've got Stefan Musignac.
Thank you, Stefan.
I tried my best on that name, Stefan. I hope I got it. Next up, we have Alan.
Thank you, Alan.
Then Andrew.
Oh, thank you, Andrew.
Tim Pasco.
Thank you, Tim.
And Matt O'Loon.
Thank you, Matt.
That's my name.
That's your name.
Thank you to all our Patreon supporters. We have a goal that we are trying to reach to create more new Movie Fighters content to go along with our War Rocket Ajax bonus content on Patreon. Also, our Patreon backers get lots of cool new stuff. We're actually going to be making new t-shirts in the next month or two, and we're going to try to have other cool new stuff for our Patreon supporters in the very near future. So if you would like to support us, you can do so by going to patreon.com/warrocketajax.
I'm back on the train of doing art for each episode, which means I drew Master Pandemonium today for all of our Patreon backers. So hey, look, I'm not saying that you need to go and back Patreon, and look, it's fine if you don't. But if you want to see me drawing Master Pandemonium, there's really only one way to do it.
It's a real value add, let me tell you. All right, Chris, it is time now to do some checks and recs.
Let's do it.
Chris, what's going on with you this week?
Well, Matt, this is a check that is kind of a wreck.
Interesting. We do these sometimes, occasionally.
That's right, Matt. And honestly, the only reason this is not an actual wreck is because it is a book that I have not read yet. I'm only about 12 pages into it. But I got an advanced copy of Glenn Weldon's new book, The Caped Crusade. You may know Glenn Weldon from NPR. You may know him as the writer of a book about Superman from a few years ago. And this is his follow-up. And it is, of course, all about Batman. And it's a cultural history of Batman. And it kind of takes the premise that the reason that we like Batman so much is because he's a huge nerd, which I like a lot. I can't wait to actually sit down and get through it. I actually have a highlighter sitting on my nightstand for when I read this so that I can go through it and mark passages that I'm going to want to talk about later. But I was very excited to get this book because a couple years ago, I think summer of 2014, Glenn actually got in touch with me and he was like, and you know, we follow each other on Twitter. He has had very nice things to say about me in the past. And he was like, hey, I'm writing a book about Batman. Can I call you and we talk about Batman for a little while? And of course, Matt, you know how I hate to talk about Batman.
Yeah, it is such a chore for you.
He twisted my arm. So I got on for this 45-minute Skype call, which was then 2 hours by the time I was done. And Glenn's really smart and really funny, and he's a great writer. And I talked to him all about like my considerable opinions about Batman. And it's so great to see like that the book kind of is finally coming out. It's actually going to be on sale on March 22nd if you feel like picking it up yourself. But I do want to point out that because I'm an egomaniac, because I'm a raging narcissist, the first thing I did was flip to the acknowledgments to see if I made it in there. And not only did I make it in, I am the first person mentioned in the acknowledgments. and it says... and you can consider this a pull quote for the book as well. The world's leading Batmanologist, Chris Sims, talked to me at length, which is good because there's no way I could have written this book if he hadn't. In said discussions, I only elicited two, Glenn, here's why you're wrongs, and I consider that a victory. So that is just, you know, take solace in the fact that I treat everyone that way, I guess.
We got to have him as a guest on the show sometime.
I would love to get Glenn on the show. And in fact, I should probably read this book before March so that we can make that happen.
Yeah.
But definitely, G.H. Weldon on Twitter is Glenn. And like I said, he's on NPR and a bunch of other places. Check him out and check this book out. Because it was a joke for me to tell him he was wrong twice. I did really love the thoughts that he had about Batman, and I'm really enjoying reading the book. So definitely check that out. Matt, what's your check this week?
My check is that I have once again peeked my head into the sometimes scary, sometimes weird, often fun, but sometimes not world of stand-up comedy, in that I performed it this week, last Tuesday, and I'm planning to perform it again in the near future. Here in Asheville, the town where I live right now, my wife actually does improv with her improv group, Blacklist, every week at a place called The Auditorium. And basically what they do when they do their improv show is open for an open mic night. They've been doing this for months now, and I just have not worked up the nerve to go sign up for the open mic night, either because I've had something to do that particular Tuesday night, or I just didn't feel like I was ready to do it or whatever. And this past Tuesday, I was just like, I'm doing it. It's fine. I'm doing it. So I got my gusto up and I went and I did stand up in the middle of an open mic, and it was a lot of fun. And now I just want to do it all the time. Like, I've been thinking so much about stand-up material. Like, I've got like six different creative things going on right now, and in some ways it's exhausting, but in other ways it's completely invigorating. Like, I mentioned that I'm working on another book that's going, I got some comic stuff that I'm working on right now, and I've been doing stand-up. It's really cool. And one thing that I've kind of, that's kind of dawned on me is, like, I did, you know, this 5 minutes material that I really like honed and worked on this past Tuesday. And because this is an open mic where a lot of times the same people are showing up every week, I got to have new stuff if I'm going to go do more. So I got to work on new material. So I've just like you know, when I'm in the shower or when I'm like just kind of pacing around or making my lunch or whatever, I'm thinking about stand-up material now, which is sort of weird and sort of invigorating. And like, I know every once in a while I come on this show and I'm like, yeah, I did stand-up again. And then you don't hear about it for months or years after that. But now I have kind of a regular outlet to do it. And it's not a place where I have to like sit through dozens of other comics to do 3 minutes at 2 a.m., which is what happened in Chicago all the time. Like here, I'm more or less guaranteed a spot to do five before, you know, 11 p.m., which I can handle. That I can do. So because that is there now and I have worked up the nerve to do it, I'm going to keep doing it.
Well, Matt, that is very exciting. I will say, I talk to you literally every day, and I had no idea you were going to do stand-up again. So I was surprised and excited when I saw on Twitter that you mentioned it.
It kind of came out of nowhere. Part of what got me to do it, okay, is when I lived in Chicago, this friend, mutual friend of my wife and mine, she was in improv classes with Marlene, but she was also doing stand-up around town, and she had actually – her name's Katie Hughes, by the way. She's a stand-up comedian. She travels around and does stand-up. She's great. You should go see her. But she had this showcase in Chicago that she used to do, and she actually invited me to be on it, even though I don't think she ever saw me do stand-up. We just kind of knew each other, and we talked, and I was like, yeah, I've done some stand-up before. Here are some of my jokes. And she was like, yeah, do my showcase. So I did her showcase. I was like the opener. And it was great. But it was like kind of my only opportunity that I got to do that. She's from here. She's from Asheville. And she is temporarily back here for a couple months. So I knew that she was going to be at this show. And somehow that kind of lit a fire under me like, man, I should do stand-up. So I did it. Let's make some recommendations, Chris. What do you have to recommend?
Well, Matt, it's time once again for us to swim in the money bin and sound the payola air horn. That's right, folks. It is payola times to the extreme. Now, if you pay attention to Pokemon or things that are like Pokemon, then you may have already heard of a video game called Yo-Kai Watch. It was developed by Level 5, who are the people behind the Professor Layton games, which I'm a big fan of. If you listen to this show long enough, then you know that I already have this fascination with Japanese yokai. When this game came together with the promise of kind of a Pokemon-style aesthetic and a Pokemon-style fight monsters and befriend them, and then they become part of your crew and you go off and have adventures. Like, it's a game I've been interested in for a long time, and it's something that came to America late last year with there's an anime, there's the video game, I'm sure there's... I know there's manga, but I don't know if it has made it to America yet. Toys, all kinds of stuff. So the PR people emailed me and they were like, hey, would you like some – or actually, I don't even think they emailed me. I think it's just a box of Yo-Kai Watch toys arrived at my apartment one day. And I opened it up and I was like, oh, this is cool. And then they emailed me and they were like, hey, did you get that box of toys for babies that we sent you? And I was like, yes, I did. But mostly what I would be interested in checking out would be the video game or comics. And they were like, cool, we'll send you the video game. And I was like, awesome, because I've been waiting. I've been trying to score a copy of it. So they sent me a copy of this video game that I've wanted to play. But Matt, they also sent me a brand new 3DS on which to play it. Level 5's PR people are not messing around. So I just want to put all of that out there so you know, grain of salt to everything. But in all honesty, I have been playing Yo-Kai Watch and I've been really, really enjoying it. The comparisons to Pokemon are inevitable and they're spot on in terms of how the game works. You do just kind of run around and fight monsters and then every now and then they join your crew. It's the variations that I think make it really interesting. There's no like Pokeball system and there's no random encounters. You have the option. You have like a little radar on your screen, and it tells you when there's one nearby, when there's a yokai nearby. And so you can go and look. And so there's these little additional screens. Like there'll be one that's, you know, a tree, or there'll be one that's a riverbank, or underneath a vending machine, or a shitty apartment is one of them, weirdly enough. And so you choose whether or not you want to grind levels, whether or not you want to try and find more yokai to be friends with, or whether you want to advance the main story without kind of dealing with all that. That's pretty cool. Another thing that's cool about it is it all takes place in one city, which is a super nice city that I want to live in, which unfortunately I don't think is an option. Instead of having this thing where you're kind of wandering from town to town, you do have these day-to-day adventures in this city that is extremely haunted. It's very cartoony and very funny in a very kid-friendly way. But then it gets really real. Like, it gets super real on your ass. Immediately, like half an hour into the game, like you're just like there's a weird little ghosty man, and he's like, I'm a yokai butler, I'll be your friend and tell you all about the yokai. And then I think the third one that you meet as the story goes on is named Jibanyan. He's my favorite. He's a cat who was run over by a truck, and his owner didn't really care. So he spends all his time training to fight trucks so that he can prove his worth to his owner, who has forgotten about him before he died. Then the next thing that happens is you go home and your parents are fighting and yelling at each other. And it's like, oh yeah, sometimes your parents fight, but don't worry. That's just yokai that are making them fight, and it's your responsibility to... to exercise these demons and keep peace in your household.
That is a lot to put on a kid.
Yes, it is. Like I said, it gets mega real. It's also divided up into episodes, I guess, like, because they are structured like cartoons. Like, there's a little title screen and everything for each level with a title, like The Secret of Such and Such. So it feels like very dramatic in a very surprising way. Given how like cartoony and ridiculous it is at its heart, but it all kind of makes for a very, very fun game. I'm really enjoying it. I wish I wasn't so swamped with other stuff and that I could just sit down and blow through it. But it feels like something that is unfortunately going to be regarded as a stopgap between Pokemon games. Like, if you want to play a new Pokemon game, but you're all caught up and the next one's not out for a while, go play Yo-Kai Watch. But it does have a lot of really cool merits on its own. The battle system, I think, is really interesting because you have six in your party, but three at a time fight, and you can rotate them in and out using the touchscreen. And they fight on their own. Like, it is your job to actively help them. But they will, like, you could start a battle and sit the 3DS down, and assuming your party doesn't all get killed or knocked out or whatever, like, they will fight the battle using regular attacks completely on their own. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff, and I'm really liking it. I will probably talk more about it when I get a little further into the game. I think I'm only on the fifth or sixth episode. But so far, very, very enjoyable, completely apart from the unexpected benefit of a brand new console sitting on my desk right now. Matt, what is your recommendation?
My recommendation is a phone game, an iPhone game, that also has watch capabilities, I think, but I didn't do any of the watch stuff. And it's actually one of three, and I'm hoping to play the other two pretty soon. But I've only played the first one so far. It's called Lifeline, and it is essentially a choose-your-own-adventure, but presented almost like a text-based RPG. So here's how it works. You start the game, and you get this message from a character who is stranded on a moon. There was a crash, and he is stranded on this moon, and he just starts asking you to tell him what to do. Like, he'll say, like, this is my situation. This is where I am. I can see these things. Should I do this or should I do this? And you basically make a choice for him and you tell him, do this. And he always does what you say, no matter how crazy it sounds. So there are so many different possibilities for how the game can turn out. Essentially, what you're trying to do is just help him survive and get off the moon. There's a lot of different things that can happen. There are a lot of twists and turns in the story, and it plays out in real time, kind of. So when you tell him to do something, he'll say, like, okay, I'm going to do that. Give me a few minutes. And then it'll just pop up and it'll say that he's busy. And then you wait until he's not busy. And he'll, like, message you back and say, like, okay, I did that. Here's the result of what I did. So you're the advisor to this stranded person on a deserted moon somewhere in space. And I don't want to give anything else about the story away, because there's some really cool, like, little surprises that come. It's sort of, you know, just plays out like a story. Again, the thing that I think is the closest thing to compare it to is a choose your own adventure, but you're choosing it for somebody else. And like when he goes to sleep, you have to wait for him to wake up, which in some ways can be maybe like frustrating if you want to sit down and play a game for a while, because you can only kind of play this in bursts. But at the same time, it makes it feel like you're really helping a person. After you complete the game once, you can set it so that it happens a lot faster. You don't have those waiting periods. But I feel like the waiting periods add a lot to sort of the atmosphere of it. It's really neat and really enjoyable, and it makes me want to play the other two really badly. I've gotten maybe three or four of the different outcomes in the first one, and things have gone pretty differently every time, just based on a couple choices. So there's like a really big branching tree of outcomes. If that sounds like something you would be into, then go grab Lifeline. I actually grabbed it, the first one, when it was free. I don't know if it's still free, but there is a bundle that you can buy of all three games for $3.99, which seems like a pretty good deal. That's like a dollar and change per game. That's not so bad. Those are recommendations. Chris, let's talk about some comics.
Let's do it.
Where do you want to start, Chris? You want to start with Midnighter?
I think I do, because Midnighter is amazing consistently. It's super fun. It's super action-packed. It's a pure action-adventure comic. And it has done something that I thought was impossible when the New 52 reboot happened, which is that it has made Midnighter fit into the DC universe and not feel redundant to Batman in a way that's really cool. And in this issue in particular, like, if you haven't been reading it, I feel like you could start with this issue, because this is kind of the start of a story where Midnighter's fighting the Suicide Squad. And it's the only thing that you have to know. And honestly, it's not even really something you have to know, because it is covered in the story. But it is kind of building off of something that happened in that free 8-page preview that you can still get for free at Comixology. So if you've been curious about Midnighter, for the price of a single issue, you can go get this issue and that 8-page preview and get a nice little 28-page introduction to the character. I should tell you right now, the first thing that happens in this comic is that Midnighter goes to a space station that is shielded from teleporting by getting into a giant bullet and shooting himself out of a giant gun into space.
Yes.
And that's where the issue starts. It's a hoot. I love it.
What's also interesting is that it, you know, you talked about Midnighter fitting into the DC universe when there's already a Batman. And in some sense, he's kind of bringing some other Wildstorm stuff with him. Because another, I don't know if I want to spoil it, but there's another major Wildstorm character who is discussed heavily in this issue. Now, I know it's, okay, I'll spoil it. It's Henry Bendix. I know that he played a part in the Stormwatch series, that was around when the New 52 launched. But this almost seems like a reintroduction of that character, too.
I didn't read much of the Stormwatch series when the New 52 relaunched. I mean, I read the first couple of issues because I read the first couple of issues of everything. But I am kind of choosing to read Midnighter as a sequel to the Warren Ellis Stormwatch.
Yeah, that's
the authority
that is,
never happened.
That's sort of
it's
what
just
it feels
Warren
like.
Ellis Stormwatch in the DC universe.
It's really kind of what it feels like. I think purposely this Midnighter series is designed such that you do not have to have a familiarity with that Stormwatch New 52 series. And I think that's very smart.
You don't need really anything to jump in. But if you have read that Warren Ellis Stormwatch series and you like the tone of that and you like, you know, the same kind of Morrison corner of the DC universe that's being explored in Grayson, which I think between the two of us, those are exactly our jam.
Yeah.
Like that's what we're here for. Then this series is that stuff. I'm way more excited about seeing Midnighter fight this Suicide Squad than I have been for anything this Suicide Squad has done in the past 4 years, 5 years.
Yeah, it's really enjoyable. And like even down to, you know, the new guy on the Suicide Squad who can predict your every, who can see into the future and know what you're going to do before you do it.
Yeah, that's the other thing I wanted to talk about, because it is genuinely hilarious to me that the like this is a series where the Midnighter keeps fighting other dudes with computer brains. Which, like, and it's great, because if he was like, if it was like a kung fu comic, he would just be fighting other martial artists, but it's not. He's a guy with a computer brain, so he's going to fight guys with computer brains. This shit's brilliant, man.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And if you want a place to jump on this new Midnighter series, this is a good one. This is a good one to jump in with. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Up next, I'm going to talk a little bit about Spider-Man number one. This is the new Miles Morales-specific Spider-Man series. With art, or that's written by Brian Michael Bendis, with art by Sarah Pacelli. And there is such a wide gulf for me between the comics where Bendis is trying to make characters that have kind of been assigned to him work, or seemingly so, and those where he just loves these characters so much. And you can tell how much he really loves Miles Morales and the supporting cast in this book, because this, you know, this book is, this first issue is, you know, standard length, 20 some pages of story, and it feels like it ends so quickly. And in some ways, you know, that's, I guess, a criticism. In other ways, it's like the highest compliment, where like you burn through a comic and you're like, it's already over. And it's not even because of, you know, quote unquote decompression, the stuff that Bendis gets saddled with all the time. It's because there's a lot that happens in this book, but it's all told in kind of a sprightly way where you just burn through this thing. So when I hit that last page, I was like, where's the rest? You know? Because this is one of those sort of classic Spider-Man setups where Spider-Man ends up being the last person standing in this huge fight that drew in the Avengers against an enemy that is so far beyond what Spider-Man ought to be able to handle. And that is where this book jumps off. In addition to just having some Miles Morales like character reintroduction and talking to his parents and talking to Genki at school and sort of inserting him into the regular Marvel universe instead of the Ultimate Universe. Like, his home life is different now. Like, he's not just his dad anymore. Now he's got his mom and his dad, which is an interesting dynamic. I'm glad we once again have a superhero with both parents, which you don't see a lot of. So there's a lot of ground to cover in here, and yet it still manages to tell this big story and then end on a cliffhanger where you're like, what? No. Where's the rest? So I feel like it's a really good first issue. I have always liked Miles Morales as a character. I feel like he tends to bring out the best in Bendis, and Sarah Pacelli's art is, like, it's always been great. She takes it to a whole other level on this number one issue. It's so good. It's gorgeous and detailed and polished in a way that you don't always see in you know, monthly comic art. So I couldn't recommend this comic more. I feel like it's a little bit of a double-edged sword to say, like, man, it ended fast. But I tend to think more positively about it in this case than maybe in other cases. The last comic that we're going to talk about, Chris, is Batgirl number 48.
That's right, Matt. Batgirl continues to be great. And I really love that there are so many stories in Batgirl that are about attacking Barbara Gordon in ways that you wouldn't really expect from a superhero comic, like attacking her in terms of identity, attacking her in terms of her intentions versus her reality, and attacking her in terms of memory. I feel like the current series has played up the idea of Barbara Gordon as having a photographic memory and being, you know, really super smart in a way that I was really worried would be lost when she wasn't Oracle anymore. And that's, like, it's been a part of the book and it's been great. And to see it kind of coming together again in this issue, where the plot is that Barbara, who has a photographic memory, has been having memory lapses. And she doesn't know why. And she's been having these nightmares. And it turns out the person in her nightmares is real and can control her memory. All that stuff is really great. And then on top of that stuff, in this issue, Batgirl and Batwing briefly become video game luchadors. And it's awesome. It's really great.
I mean, that sounds fantastic. I've got to catch up on Batgirl, but
there's a lot of weird wrestling content in DC Comics these days that I am all for.
Hey.
I am all for seeing the wrestling content.
It's full-on pandering to the War Rocket Ajax contingent. And I am fine with that.
Yes.
All right, Chris. It is time for us to take a short little break. We're going to come back from that break, however, and we are going to jump into our interview segment with Veronica Fish. And we are very excited about that. So let's rush through this break and get to talking to Veronica.
We will get through this break as fast as we can. Program this week is someone that I'm very excited to talk to. She is an artist who you probably know most recently for her work on Archie. We have Veronica Fish here on the show. Veronica, welcome to War Rocket Ajax.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I have a question to start off with, and yeah. I already feel like you are either have gotten this question a million times or going to get this question a million times.
You're just like, oh, that's why you got the job, right? Because your name's, yeah.
Yeah, you knew where I was going. Matt and I were talking because we made a list of guests that we wanted to have on the show at the beginning of the year. And your name was on there because we absolutely love what you're doing on Archie. But are you the first person with the name of one of the characters to ever work on those books?
You know what? If that's true, then that's totally going on the epitaph for sure. Maybe I've done some like wiki research and I think it's a strong possibility. I mean, Veronica isn't a super popular name, so yeah, maybe.
Look, I've read a lot of Archie comics and I've never seen a Jughead credited. That is for sure.
I know that you're definitely an aficionado. So I'm a little bit worried about that because, believe it or not, I did not grow up reading Archie comics, like, at all. So I'm worried that you're going to, like, quiz me and I'm going to totally fail any of those.
That, you know what? That is the new format of the show, is I bring people on and I quiz them.
About Archie history.
Welcome to War Rocket Ajax Gatekeepers, our special new podcast.
I came into Archie super late, maybe until I wasn't like 16 or 17, but no one in my family read comics. The only comics that were available were whatever was in my dad's, like, subscription to the New Yorker and whatever came in the Sunday dailies. So it really wasn't until I actually started working at a comic book shop that, like, my world just exploded and I became a huge fan. So sadly, I'm like catching up on Archie now, but I guess that's not really a bad thing. I mean, you come into certain stories at different parts of your life anyway, and you can't really control whether you grow up with something or not. So
as someone who didn't really grow up around comics, how did you fall into working at a comic shop?
I knew that I really wanted to draw. So I was actually taking a cartooning class at a local art museum. And in that class, actually was the guy who would later be my future husband, amazingly. And he was like, oh, you like cartoons. You should totally like go shop at That's Entertainment, which is our local comic book shop. And I needed a job because I was 16. So I started working there. It was just like, suddenly you could see in color for the first time. It was like that kind of just diving into everything that I could get my hands on, and comics just became like a new obsession. So I kind of had to educate myself pretty quick, because it was super evident how little I knew when, like, people would come in for their subs. It was embarrassing. I'd be like, I don't know what the significance of this, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example, but like something everyone knows, like the first appearance of Batman was like the Detective Comics 27, and I just didn't know anything. It was really, really bad. So I just read like crazy, and it was great, really great.
Well, you were 16.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not, I mean, that's not, you know, coming to comics too terribly late.
Oh, okay. It's just like my circle of friends. It's like something people have grown up with forever. So I didn't know if that was late or not. Almost like being a gymnast, you know, you can't start when you're 16, you can't start like when you're 3.
I often consider comics to be the gymnastics of literature.
Okay.
So did you just primarily come from like watching cartoons and being really into animation?
Yeah, that was totally the door that kind of opened up. Like I would get up super early in the morning, to get my big bowl of cereal, and I would actually get up at 6 because that's when they would show Sailor Moon. And I had never seen animation like that. I would try and like sneak in viewings of like Beavis and Butthead, and my mom would get really mad at me because she's like, "That's a bad cartoon for teenagers." And I would like try and sneak as much, you know, cartoons as possible from like all different areas. And then when I started working at the comic shop, I was like, "Oh my god, wait a minute! Like everything that I'm watching came from a comic book. Like all of my favorites, like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and you know all these great things." I was said, "Oh, and actually, believe it or not, Pee Wee's Playhouse, Gary Panter had some really crazy like underground comics." And when I read those, I made the connection that Gary Panter was the production designer on Pee Wee. I was like, "Whoa, it's all coming together." It was exciting. But yeah, it was definitely animation that was the beginning.
Well, Veronica, you just said the magic words, because I have a whole other podcast about Sailor Moon, and we'll have to talk about that later.
Oh my god, that's so great! I was actually probably like most teenage girls. That was like the reason why I started to learn Japanese. I was like, "Oh, I'm just gonna totally like read manga. It's gonna be great." And then suddenly realizing that you can't just pick it up in like a couple of comic books. It's like a life lifetime of study. But anyway, that's really cool that you have another Sailor Moon podcast. I must listen to this.
look, we'll talk about it later. I will cover that in a future email. But I am curious, like, what was the comic, like, was it just seeing that, like, all the stuff that you already liked, like Sailor Moon, you know, had its roots in there, like you talked about, or was there one comic that you saw and you were like, oh, this is what I want to do? Because I feel like a lot of people who work in comics, so many of us have worked in comic book stores. I did my 6 years in retail. You know, you do hit that one and you're like, oh, I want to do this. Like, I'm not just someone who is a fan of this anymore. I want to do this. So was there a comic like that for you?
Absolutely. It was Will Eisner's The Dreamer.
Really?
Light bulb went off. And I read it probably 9 or 10 times. And at that time, I didn't know any of the people who are referenced in that comic book. Like, I had no idea that Jack King was Jack Kirby. I had no idea any of the other people who worked in Eisner's, like, stable. I didn't know that. I didn't even know that was Eisner himself. So for me, it was a new experience as, like, just being able to appreciate a character going through the beginnings of the comic book industry. And then as someone who was trying to struggle with, do I go to art school? Do I not go to art school? So watching someone deal with creative issues and kind of having to get the confidence to go into art. Stephen Pressfield has a really great line in one of his books where he says, it was easier for Hitler to start World War II than it was to be an artist. And that line stuck with me so much because I just think that, like, self-doubt and all of that stuff is so, it's the thing that can consume an artist and, you know, any person who does creative work, and it can just kill you. Like, it can just bury you. So reading about someone like Eisner, who was pretty confident in who he was and he knew what he wanted to do, was inspiring. Like, and I had never seen comics like that. Like, I had never seen panels that didn't have borders, and yet you could read the flow pretty well. And then so after The Dreamer, I just became obsessed with all of his work, and I would buy, like, I would spend my whole paycheck on just anything. Like, even his 70s stuff, he did this really cheesy, like, astrology book that I think Kitchen Sink Press had reprinted. And I just had to, like, I just had to own everything he did that was in my price range. I remember that very specifically. I remember holding the cover, that it was the orange and yellow cover, and reading it, and just, it was like burned into my brain, you know? And I just thought, maybe I can do it. Maybe I can actually go to art school and make it happen. And so Will Eisner himself was actually teaching at the school that I had gone to. I went to the School of Visual Arts, but he had actually stopped teaching right as I was getting there. So I never met him or anything, but feel like his spirit was kind of, oh, hey, didn't even mean to make that pun. His spirit was there.
His Will Eisner, the spirit was there.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, I have that, not that copy, but I have that printing of The Dreamer, like, sitting over on my bookshelf. And I will say, that is my favorite Will Eisner comic.
Yeah, cool.
And, I mean, it's my favorite Will Eisner comic because it's the Will Eisner comic that has Jack Kirby in it.
So you could appreciate everything, like, all the facets to it.
But it's such an interesting, for a new comics reader, that's such an interesting book because it's so deep cut in a lot of ways. Like, it's, you know, about the Eisner and Iger studios, and it's got all those golden age guys in it. But then it is a comic about making comics, and I can totally see how inspirational that could be. I mean, it was certainly inspirational when I read it, and I came to it, you know, God, and like at like 28 reading it.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, now that you mentioned that you knew it was Kirby, I do remember reading that panel where Kirby, Jack King jumps off of his chair. He's got his finger mafia guy's face, and he's like, "You get out of here." And I thought that was so cool. I was like, "I want to know this guy. Like, he seems like someone that I want to be friends with." And then the more that I've actually heard about what a totally stand-up guy Kirby was, the more I started to appreciate his work and his life. So, and I wouldn't have made the connection between those two characters that like here actually was a real life tough guy who like stood up for what he believed in and wasn't scared. It's super cool. So
did you go from there? And I should say, anybody out there who hasn't read The Dreamer, even if you're not generally an Eisner fan, the part with Jack King is amazing because it is a true story. And the only thing that Eisner takes liberty with is the fact that he draws Jack Kirby as around 3 feet tall, which is great.
Ouch. He wasn't that short, right?
he's a stocky, tough man, is Jack Kirby. But did you go from, like, Eisner, did you go into, like, other Golden Age creators? Like, did you kind of follow, like, oh, I need to read Jack Cole, I need to read Jack Kirby? Like, or was it just, was that your one thing that you were focused on while you were catching up on everything else?
Let's see. Well, I think because I was attracted to relationships between people, and then, like, at that time, the stuff that was big was, like, Spawn and, like, Cable. So the mainstream titles at that point really weren't interesting to me because I couldn't get invested in those characters. So what was interesting was going back to Golden Age stuff. But at the same time, I was kind of searching for stories that were kind of more, like, human and relationship-based. So while I haven't read the whole Batman canon, I would ask people, like, oh, like, what's your favorite, like, run? And he's my husband now, but at the time, Andy was like, oh, you should read the Silver St. Cloud, you know, run of Batman. And that Marshall Rogers who did?
Yeah, that's Stephen Gohart and Marshall Rogers.
Yeah. So, like, I would read kind of, like, arcs as opposed to just kind of, like, going through chronologically because it was just overwhelming. So I did that, and then I did, like, the classic, well, it's classic for me, but the Elektra, the Frank Miller Elektra arc. So I would kind of, like, find recommendations from people that I trusted, like, hey, like, if I wanted to really, like, what's your, you know, what are your favorite pieces and, like, what do you recommend for me? So if that way going into a comic book shop felt more approachable for me as opposed to being like, look at all these back issues. I don't want to read all of this. I would kind of hop from artists that I like just visually, and then get recommendations for stories that people liked. So from there, I went to Paul Grist. huge fan of Paul Grist. Like, I don't know if he does cons outside of England, but if he does, I'm there. I want to meet him and tell him how much I care about his work.
Veronica, you don't know it because this is the first time we've ever talked. You don't know it, but you are just naming off my favorite things.
Yay! Internet high five, Chris. Bam. I just, like, did an air high five.
I am on record, like first of all, Strange Apparitions, legit one of the best Batman runs of all time. So good. Second of all, Jack Staff is literally my favorite superhero comic of all time.
Oh, cool. He's one of the most brilliant, just visual, I don't know if this makes sense, like, he's like a visual thinker, the way he can pare down everything into just black and white. Man, that takes real genius, you know?
Yeah, Paul Grist's layouts, like, I read them, and like, with a lot of comics, you know, you go in and you try to reverse engineer, right? You try to be like, okay, how did it get to this? What can I learn from this? And Grist's layouts and Jack Staff just make me mad, because it's like, I don't, no one else could do this.
Yeah, he, just the way he and incorporates all these amazing sound effects, and sometimes the sound effect is the negative space and sometimes it's the background, and you just feel like you're in it. You feel like you're in the episode, and like the sound is all around you. And I absolutely love the way he draws women.
Yes.
With these like super broad shoulders and big puffy jackets. And every woman has a very specific kind of fashion sense. Even though it's very simple, it's incredible. Incredible work.
Who is your favorite character in Jackstaff? Because there's 40 to choose from.
Oh my God. Oh man. It's going to be such a pop out if you can probably hear me typing, because I haven't read it in like 5 years. Well, I do love the robot.
Tom Tom the Robot Man?
Yeah.
who is neither a robot nor a man.
Yeah. I just love, didn't he have an entrance that was just like this giant boom, and then they discover his tracks later? Oh, and then the guy, I'm sorry, I can't believe it. I can't believe I'm blanking out, but I can see them. Yeah, Paul Crest's work, he's the kind of artist that I want to see how he would tackle every character, like ever. Like I want to see him do Superman. I want to see him do an issue of just everything, because I just think he has that voice, you know?
Yeah, it's one of the biggest missed opportunities in comics, for, like, it, as far as I'm concerned, is when they were doing Solo at Vertigo, that there wasn't a Paul Grist one. Or was there? No, I'm typing. No, there was not a Solo Paul Grist, so good. That is a travesty that I can continue talking about.
Well, to switch gears for a second, because talking about Kirby and how, you know, originally reading The Dreamer, you didn't have an awareness of the real people that those characters were based on.
Right.
It seems as though, like, I guess there was absolutely, you know, that big moment of clarity where you went back and looked at The Dreamer and you were like, oh yeah, all these people are these people. Because,
yeah,
like, I can tell, I just from your blog, you've got some great process stuff on your blog. And I was just looking at the post about the process on the Howard the Duck issue that you worked on. And
right.
Talking about how authentic you wanted the Silver Surfer page to be. You know, how Kirby realistic you wanted it to be. Did you feel kind of a weight doing that? Like, oh man, I'm drawing Silver Surfer. I gotta get this right.
That I am obsessed over that so much, and I'm super lucky because my husband Andy actually knew Kirby in real life. He erased some of his pencils, and he had met him at a convention, and he kind of was his mail order assistant. So Kirby would kind of like mail letters to Andy, and had a nice kind of like mentor relationship for a few years before he had passed away. So I obsessively looked over all of these things, like all these different versions of like the way Kirby draw Silver Surfer super angry and like screaming. And so there was actually a review where someone had said, he's a much angrier Silver Surfer. And that made me laugh, because to me, it's like, oh yeah, I guess I was only referencing all these like, like Kirby yelling images. He helped me out doing some of the color blocking, because I wanted it to transition from Rico Renzi's beautiful kind of modern colors. But then I really wanted, when the Surfer came in, to try and even get back to that kind of Pantone, you know, CMYK separation. I tried everything I could do to make it so referential that people would get what I was trying to do, because I think you almost set yourself up for a mistake if you try and go halfway. You know, if you're trying to pay homage to someone, you have to do it as best you can, as clear as you can, so it doesn't come off like, you know, a sad facsimile. So I obsessed over those very, very much. And I'm sure I'll look back at them in a few months and be like, oh man, I could have done that better. But you can't, like, you just kind of go forward, you know, as much as you can, and try not to worry about your older work. But yeah, Kirby is, he is like such an art god to me in so many ways, from everything. He's such a consummate artist, from comics to painting to collages and design, that like you can't help but in your tiny way, you like leave this little breadcrumb like for him in the ether and be like, is this okay? These few panels and Howard the Duck too.
Talking about going forward, there is something that I desperately wanted to talk to you about, which is that you, in addition to drawing Archie, you also drew the promo art for the Riverdale CW series that sounds completely bananas, and I can't wait for it. I'm so excited.
I know, right? Like, they keep making all these references to, like, Twin Peaks and how it's going to be subversive, so can't wait to see what that means visually. Yeah,
That very first article where it was like, Archie's got a dark secret and Betty's on Adderall and Veronica's father's in jail. I was like, yes, give me more of this.
I'm in.
What did they tell you when, like, did they just say, hey, draw the cast of Archie as though they were on the CW? Or did they give you details on that?
They were really, really cool because they just kind of let me... they just kind of let me go and do my thing. I got very few notes on that. I think the only note that I got was like, make Veronica hotter and make Valerie like a little bit edgier. And that was pretty much it. They're super cool. So at that point, because I had actually done that image before I knew they were interested in my work for the main series. So that's why Archie has kind of a different look than the first few issues of the reboot. And I kind of given him like almost like a pug nose, but he does have like that kind of cute, younger, pushed up nose. And in the comics, he's kind of got a bit of more of like a sleeker face. So there is a part of me that kind of wants to, like, I'm questioning, should I reference the Riverdale image because I actually like it when I go forward on the issues, but I don't want to change the way that the characters look too much already in the printed ones. So it's kind of a weird juggling act of like, how do you let yourself as an artist kind of evolve how the characters look because you're just getting better at drawing them and doing what you want to see personally. Responsibility to the reader. So
I want to ask you this question. How mad are you going to be if they don't cast actors that look exactly like your drawings for the show? Because you've established the look.
Totally don't. I don't even worry about that. I had seen some article that even said that they were already casting, or that they were looking at, oh my goodness, I think she was a Colombian actress for Veronica, which I thought was pretty cool, but I'm not really sure on that. So yeah, I mean, TV is such a grab bag. Like, the way that, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people auditioned for one spot. And I mean, I don't know, like you could end up with 1,000 different possibilities if all of these shows were developed. So I don't know, but I definitely don't take it personally if they don't look at my art at all. So that's okay.
Well, while we're on the topic of characters that look like real people or vice versa, there's another post on your blog that I think is really interesting about Archie number 5, and where you're kind of pointing out the Easter eggs of, you know, characters who look like people from your life, and your nod to Chip Zdarsky and your nods to some of your previous work. Is like, I'm sure that's something that has happened in comics forever, like people putting people they know into comics, but because of Tumblr and blogs and stuff like that, there's so much more of an ability to point that out. Like, is that something you really enjoy doing, you know, beyond just this one issue, just being like, here's all the cool stuff I put in that you would never notice unless I told you.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to blogging the Easter eggs for every issue because there are going to be lots and lots of those things. I don't mind if people aren't interested, because it's just interesting for me personally. So if I'm the only one who's reading my own blog post being like, yeah, that was so cool when Philip was in there, haha, like, I'm okay with that. But yeah, it is something that I'm hoping to keep going. And actually, I do have to thank Chip. And in Mark's script, the only thing for that panel with the fake ID was, you know, Archie hands Reggie the fake. So I was like, oh man, opportunity, right? Like right there, who is going to be on this ID? Because the only thing that had to be there was just simply Archie's angry face. So that every time Reggie looks at this card, he's like, oh yeah. So Chip was actually the one who got me Archie job. He would like me to clarify. I got myself the Archie job because I sent in samples and I auditioned for it. But they contacted me because of Chip. I met him at HeroesCon in 2014, and I didn't know him before that, and just luck would have it, we were sharing a kind of a corner table. I was on one side, he was on the other, and we kicked around the idea of working together and doing something for Image. And then some time had passed, and we even had a bit of a plot for a separate series. And then kind of out of the blue, I got this email that said, like, hello from Archie Comics. And I thought I had signed myself up for their email blast. I was like, oh, cool. I didn't know I was on the mailing list. So I almost didn't open it because I was like, oh, I'll just read all my comics in one day. And it was Alex Segura, who is he's the editor for the Dark Circle line and the PR manager there. And he's like, hey, do you want to do some sketches for us just to see how you would tackle the main characters? And I was so shocked. I dropped my phone and I cracked it. And Alex said in another email, like, yeah, we got your name from Chip, because Chip's working on Jughead. So I immediately, I was like, do I get Chip a fruit basket? Like, can I mail it to Canada? I think it's going to be like 22 pounds. I don't know. How do you mail a fruit basket? And like, I was running around trying to figure out ways to thank him for the opportunity. So, I just thought it'd be really nice to put Chip in there. Not because he's in the Archie team, like, but simply because he's a great guy and I thought he would laugh about it. So that's why that's there.
Well, I know that there is a response coming in Jughead, because Erica was looking for pictures of teenage Mark Waid, and Mark provided her with one.
I know. I saw that. I had actually emailed Mark. I was like, dude, I'm so sorry. Like, I don't think they know that I was the one who put Chip's name, and now like they think you did it. And he's like, oh, it's cool. So I got him in a weird position now. He's got to reveal 1981 Mark Waid. But it's not a bad picture, so not that bad.
Well, you talked about HeroesCon, Veronica, and I gotta say, there was something I told you before we started the interview that I have a pressing question that is not about your name being the same name as one of Archie's girlfriends. I was looking through your sketches on your blog, because at veronicafish.com you've got a really great section of sketches that you've done for people. They're awesome. Oh. And another one of my favorite things in the world that listeners already know about is that I'm a huge, huge fan of Kamen Rider Forze. And nice. I saw that there was a sketch of Forze, and I'm like, oh my god, if Veronica Fish likes Kamen Rider Forze, then we will have enough to talk about, no question. And then I saw that you had written for Jordan on it.
Yeah.
And then I was like, yep. I was like, oh, I've seen that sketch before. And I emailed Jordan Gibson and I was like, hey, do you have a Kamen Rider Forze by Veronica Fish?
That's right. Yeah. He was the one who introduced the character to me, because when I used to teach at a art museum, I would teach high school students, and they're because of the link of anime and comics, that was a very common favorite character. So I was just like, oh man, I gotta look up who this cool guy is with the rocket arm. It's so rad. And actually, when I was in Japan, he was everywhere. everywhere on like shampoo, like kid shampoo, on like sauce packets. This guy's huge, super, super popular for good reason.
Yeah, because he's the best.
He is the best.
Now, when I emailed Jordan, I think he mentioned that when he got the sketch, you had not watched Forza yet. Is that accurate?
I have seen so little of it, and sadly, I'm catching up half DVD.
But he said that when Betty got him a sketch of Amazonas from the Marvel Spider-Man series, that you were very excited.
Yes, very, very much so. I think that that show is amazing. I think it's such a gem. I mean, what, like, where else but Japan would they be like, oh, Spider-Man? Well, he totally has to have some transforming robot machinery to conjure up. Like, yeah, I love that. The show, I love, I love everything about it. I love the actors. I love the style, I love the makeup, the fashion. It's great. Great
stuff. And if people have not seen it, there's an amazing Kamen Rider Forze on your blog. There's an amazing Johnny Sacco and his flying robot on there.
Another commission. People know like what to ask me for.
Well, listen, Veronica, I'll tell you right now, I have a Shotaro Ishinomori sketchbook that I have been taking around. And if you are going to be at Heroes Con this year and it says on your site that you are,
then, I am.
Look, we're going to have a conversation at Heroes.
We're going to hang out, Chris. It's going to be awesome.
We'll just talk about Sailor Moon and Kamen Rider.
Yep, it's going to be great. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we're making plans for Heroes Con. That will be great. But I have to put a halt to that for the moment so that we can turn it over to our listeners on Twitter to ask a few questions of their own.
That's right, Matt. If the people who are listening to this show right now want to get in on the discussions that we have each and every Thursday night when we record War Rocket Ajax, how can they go about that?
Well, first, Chris, what they need to do is discover the secrets of Riverdale and find people that look exactly like the Riverdale promotional art and cast them on the show so that there's continuity. Or else, well, Veronica might not be mad, but I will. And then they need to go to twitter.com and sign up for an account if they don't already have one. Wait until Thursday night, trying to say too much at once. Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 6:30 Pacific. And one of us, Chris or myself, Chris at the ISB, me at the Matt D. Wilson, we will put out the call for questions. And that is when you will have the opportunity to ask questions like the ones you are about to hear for Veronica Fish. The first one we have comes from Mike Pankowski on Twitter, who asks, who should Archie meet in his next crossover?
Ooh, that is a really great question. We just had a joke about this, me and my pal Aaron, Aaron Hunting in Australia. I think Stephen King's Christine. I think that just only because she was going through some coloring books, and I could have sworn that all the kids were crunched up in like a cruiser that looked just like that evil car. And I was like, oh man, it'd be so cool if, you know, the next crossover was like Maximum Overdrive or something crazy like that. Kind of like 80s, you know, car-based horror film, I guess. But I mean, if it's me talking personally, ooh, maybe someone like St. Vincent, who I love. I don't know how that would possibly work, but that could be kind of neat.
I think Annie Clark just comes through Riverdale on tour. I think that's pretty easy to make happen.
I would freak out, and I can draw myself having a heart attack, just crying. So that's a really great question.
Tales to Enrage has a very personal question about personal taste. He wants to know who's got the best butt, Archie, Jughead, Reggie, or Moose?
That's amazing. Without thinking about it too much, I'm going to go with Reggie and then Moose. It's a tie. Because personally, I like guys who are kind of like muscly. I don't go for like, you know, and I don't go for like Jughead's body type, but I think Jughead's got a great brain. So it's a grab bag. So I'm going to go with Reggie and then Moose tied.
All right. The next question is pretty philosophical. It's from Vic Perfecto on Twitter. And it is, life or death, good or evil, Betty or Veronica?
Wow. So here's what I'm going to go with. I'm going to go with Veronica, and it's not because of my name. It's because of the way that Mark has written her. And personally, I feel like Veronica is getting a much more layered, Betty's a phenomenal character, but I really like characters that aren't so perfect. I like characters who they're not always right. And I think what's so great about Veronica is that she is so blissfully unaware of how she rubs people the wrong way, and she's totally doesn't understand when she said the wrong thing, and yet she has this really wonderful confidence about her. And I also think Veronica would be the same way, even if she didn't come from money. I think if she was a lower middle class kid or something like that, she would still have the same kind of air about her. So I'm going to go with Veronica because I feel like she's a more complex person. Right now, we'll see what's going on with Betty's character, but that's my answer.
All right. The next question comes from Yellow Banana Slug on Twitter. He wants to know, what is your approach to Jughead's crown or whatever the heck it's called?
his whoopee cap.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think kind of like Batman's ears. I think every artist is going to draw them differently. Sometimes you go for the Steve Rude tiny ears, and sometimes you go for the Kelly Jones super long ears. So I've kind of noticed that I draw the crown super big, like bigger than a whoopee cap actually would be. And I had looked it up. It's basically like when you take your dad's hat and you like cut it up because you're a bad kid. So that's why it kind of has that, like they've cut the brim to look like that crown. So technically, if it was a real cut up hat, it would be much shorter. But I have the tendency to make the crown taller than normal. So it looks a little bit strange.
Next question comes from Dan_Spaceman on Twitter. This is a question for everybody. What Archie spinoff would you like to see rebooted, and why is it Archie's RC Racers?
I don't know. Oh, boy. What spinoff? Well, I guess, have they done Josie yet?
Yeah, I think that's going to be all three of our answers, right? Right, Chris?
I mean, that's the serious answer, and the serious answer is, the serious answer is, like, for 2 years, every time I would get PR from Archie, and I would, like, reply to it, I would literally end, I'd be like, yeah, we're going to go ahead and run this preview. By the way, I want to write Josie. Like, just heads up. Like, every time I saw the Archie guys at a con, every time I was at San Diego, I'd be like, hey, Alex, by the way, I still want to write Josie. And then we did Subatomic Party Girls, and I got it out of my system. My go-to answer would be Jughead's Time Police, because that's such a bonkers book. And Chip and Erica did an amazing job kind of bringing it back in the fantasy sequence. Yeah. But I really think Archie's Weird Mysteries could have some legs, like now, like in a world where we have... where we have the Archie comics for everyone. Like, if we could have, like a teen supernatural mystery book that wasn't quite Afterlife with Archie, but it also wasn't quite, Archie and Jughead, I think that would be really fun in 2016. But yeah, it's Josie. It's obviously Josie.
That's
Josie definitely has the most potential.
Yeah, it's the easiest answer and the best answer. The next question, and probably our last one, comes from Getter404 on Twitter. They ask, you've been given the opportunity for a Reggie and or Cheryl solo book. How do you make them not the worst? Now, you've already expressed an affinity for Reggie. You may not agree with the premise of this question.
Well, kind of going back to what I had said about Veronica and the way that Mark is writing Reggie. Keep in mind that when I do interviews, like I know so far ahead of the story than what's been already published. So when I say that I like a character because I know that they're so layered and that there's a lot of great stuff coming, it's because I know that this character has more than just one opportunity to either be a jerk or now they're going to get an opportunity to be awesome. And that's what informs, you know, how I like these characters. So Reggie has such a phenomenal backstory, and he's got such phenomenal potential to be not just a bully, but there's actually something deeper there. I also like to think of Reggie as the kind of character that he is the kind of kid that gets mad when he's sad. He's so afraid of being being sad that he reacts with anger, and I think that's something that a lot of people can relate to. And maybe there are reasons why he is the way he is, because it's extremely boring. Like, if I did a Reggie Cheryl solo book, it would be so boring if Reggie was just mean for no reason, right? Like, who would care? Like, why would you want to read from the villain's personality when the villain has no other substance? So when you give people more than the one side, it's captivating. I would have to be linked up with a writer who could like feel that and could bring that through. Because for me, my job as an artist is I consider 40% how the comic book is produced. Actually, maybe even less than that when you add in the colorist and a letterer. But the writer has that 60%. And it doesn't matter how a comic book is drawn. Like, how an artist tackles something is kind of secondary, but if the story is amazing, then it's going to be a great comic book. So you would need, that's definitely a question for how would a writer like make them not terrible.
So you're talking about the Grendel/Wicked approach to Reggie.
Oh yeah, right. That's a good
Well, Veronica, you're very kind, but as writers, I think Matt and I can both agree, it's not 60%. We barely show up most of the time.
Oh, stop. It's tough. Writing is so hard.
Listen, we could have this mutual admiration fest for quite a while longer, but we have to wrap up.
Well, let's just forget about that.
Our guest has been Veronica Fish. Before we wrap up, Veronica, please tell all our listeners where they can find you online.
You can visit my portfolio site, which is veronicafish.com, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at @itsveronicafish.
Veronica Fish, you have been an absolute delight. Archie is, of course, available in print and digitally right now, and also check out all of her other stuff. It is fantastic. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. This has been really nice.
Thank you once again to Veronica Fish for joining us on the show. That was a super fun time. I cannot wait to talk to her again. But now it's time to flip the script a little bit because Matt and I are going to answer some questions.
That's right. We're going to answer some questions from our Tumblr, which is at warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. The first one is from an anonymous question asker. They want to know, how do we feel about scientific explanations for superpowers? For example, Spidey's wall crawling being a specialized application of the Van der Waals force.
Generally speaking, I hate it. I hate it so much. There are some that I like, right? Like, I like the idea. And I think a lot of this has to do with us being the age we are, you know, like we're both in our early 30s. So we were, you know, we're 90s kids. But I like the John Byrne Superman stuff. Like, I like that all of Superman's powers are essentially telekinetic or psionic. That, like, his body generates a field. So that's why his costume, like, instead of having the indestructible Kryptonian costume that he had in the Silver Age, the modern age Superman had, you know, just a field that extended a little bit past his own body. So when he wore a skin-tight suit, nothing could damage it or make it dirty. Which was cool, because then in a story like Death of Superman, when you see Superman's costume getting ripped up, you know that force field that he has is failing. And it also explains why he can lift up an airplane and not just go straight through the hole. I like it when it's stuff like that, but the simpler the power and the more complex the explanation, the more I hate it.
Yeah.
The more I'm like, no, Spider-Man sticks to walls because he was bitten by a spider and spiders climb walls.
Well, I'm fine with it being the Vanderwaals force, but just don't take it any further than that. Like, Vanderwaals force is fine. It being because he has tiny little hairs on his fingers, I don't care.
Like, oh yeah, I'm not into that.
He doesn't need that. And it's just explaining for the sake of explaining. Like, I really have to take it on a case-by-case basis. Like, essentially for me, it's just a question of, does it make sense and does it overcomplicate? If it makes sense, fine. If it gets to the point where you're just trying to shoehorn in something to make it apply to the quote-unquote real world, I don't care. If it overcomplicates it, even if it makes sense, I don't care. Like, keep it simple, and it'll be fine. If it feels like it's getting too complicated for its own good, then don't worry about explaining it. It's the same thing, like, I get sick of this overwhelming need that people feel for, like, explanations of zombies. Mm-hmm. You know, in a zombie movie, I feel like one of the things that the audiences are waiting for sometimes is, well, how did they turn into zombies? Why are these zombies coming back to life? And it's like, who cares? The best examples are in the Romero movies, where it's just like, they're just alive. And I guess it's because of nuclear stuff, right? And then in Return of the Living Dead, where it's some chemicals got burned up, and then it rained, and that stuff was in the clouds, so they came back.
Yeah. Everybody likes Neil deGrasse Tyson when he's telling us about the history of the universe. Everyone hates Neil deGrasse Tyson when he's like, BB-8 doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Like, personally, like, I feel like Neil deGrasse Tyson is, like, enjoys that so much. Like he enjoys being, like, that's his one thing where he gets to be like a huge jerk to everybody.
When he gets
I feel like he relishes it.
He gets to heel off a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. He gets to turn heel on you. But, like, no one likes that. Like, I can't think of an example of something that has hit me like that I don't like. I mean, the hairs on Spider-Man's fingers are a big one. But I do feel like there is a case-by-case basis that you have to take, because sometimes it's cool. Like my drama teacher when I was in middle school actually wrote in and got a no prize for explaining why Spider-Man's web didn't stick to his costumes. But that was never, you know, that wasn't brought up in the comics, you know?
Yeah.
That was never a point of the story. And it's something that movies feel compelled to do fucking constantly. Like, Andrew Wheeler made a joke about how so much of Batman Begins is about Alfred, like, buying material to make Batman ears. Like, Bruce Wayne has to, like, look at a little radio and be like, oh, if I could put this in my helmet, I could have a little pointy thing on my helmet. And it's like, yeah, like, We already know he's going to dress like a bat. We don't need an origin story for the ears.
They're ears, so he looks like a bat. The end.
It's a very fine line. I think you're absolutely correct on that. Very fine line.
All right. Here's another question, because we got to talk about wrestling a little bit this episode. This is from Worm2790. They want to know, aside from War Games, what is a WCW pay-per-view that should replace a WWE pay-per-view? I know the one that they should bring back. Absolutely.
Okay.
Halloween Havoc.
Yes. Yes. Except that Halloween Havoc was never good.
I mean, I guess that's true.
The problem with Halloween Havoc. Havoc is consistently garbage.
They never capitalized on the idea of Halloween Havoc like they should have. Because really all they ever did at Halloween Havoc was like some kind of opening video where Dean Malenko or whoever would be dressed in a dumb costume, and that was it. And then, like, in the entryway, they would have, like, joke gravestones, like in a Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episode, and that's, like, all they would do. Like, there would be a few Halloween decorations up, and otherwise it would just be a regular pay-per-view. I'm saying pay off on the concept of Halloween Havoc. Like, at least have wrestlers wrestle in Halloween costumes. Like, right now, their October pay-per-view is Hell in a Cell, and I get why that's the October pay-per-view, but you could really do that any time.
I think Hell in a Cell should be retired as a pay-per-view. I also feel like if you want Halloween Havoc, that's every episode of Lucha Underground.
That is true. That is true.
Because there is a zombie man sitting on a Skull of Thrones in every episode of Lucha Underground Season 2.
The other WCW pay-per-view that they should absolutely use, because it's just a great name, and it's another kind of gimmicky thing they could do, is Bash at the Beach.
Bash at the Beach is a good one. I've often wondered, and this is one of the things I did in my like WWE 2K14 game, before they were doing NXT takeovers, I was like, why don't they just have like Clash of the Champions and make that the NXT event? Because, you know, WWE owns all those names.
Yeah.
Like, they own the name Starrcade. Well, they own Clash of the Champions. They own
They used Great American Bash for a while.
Yeah. And then they combined it with Bash at the Beach, and it was just the Bash.
Yeah.
Remember that from 2006?
You know what it was a word that Dusty Rhodes loved? Bash.
Yes. He really did. But yeah, I've always thought like Clash of the Champions is such a cool name, because, and again, I want to be real, and it will never be used because WWE won. World Wrestling Entertainment is a shitty name for a company. World Championship Wrestling is the best name for a company.
It's true.
And I feel like Clash of the Champions is such a good name for a wrestling show. And I wish they would have done that instead of, like, TakeOver. And I get why TakeOver is there, because it's, you know, the younger guys and younger women taking over WWE for a night, you know?
I mean, technically they're taking over the network.
Yeah.
Which also plays into it, yeah.
And they're also taking over wrestling in general. But I wish they would do like Clash of the Champions. I wish they would do something like that. I also wish they would bring back the Lethal Lottery, which was terrible, because it was the Lethal Lottery wasn't worked, and that's so awful.
Oh, sometimes it was worked.
So, I guess sometimes it was worked, but like they did it 1 year, and it just like it was an actual random draw.
Yeah, that's pretty weird. They should also, this is not serious, but kinda, they should bring back the terrible single word names of pay-per-views that they were testing out in WCW in their last year. It was like sin. Greed. The last year of WCW is such a fascinating thing to look at.
I once said I would pay $200 for a box set of the last year of WCW, and now it's all on the network.
Yeah, you can just watch it all.
Let's go through real quick. Sold out, no. Super Bowl, terrible. Uncensored, maybe. Spring Stampede, garbage. Slambery, terrible garbage. Great American Bash and Bash of the Beach, into it. Fall Brawl, no. Halloween Havoc, yes.
Halloween Havoc is the best name. We're leaving out the biker one. Hog Wild. Hog
Wild, that they had to change the name to Road Wild?
Yeah. Halloween Havoc's the only really good one to use. Halloween Havoc or one of the bashes.
I also like Starcade, because it's like, that word is just arcade.
And it's got two R's in it, which is really frustrating. It's really frustrating that it's got two R's in it for me.
Coming at you from the Omni, Matt.
Those are our questions for this week. Thanks to the two folks that asked those questions, Worm2790 and Anonymous. If you'd like to ask us a question for a question segment, you can do so by going to warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com and asking us a question there, or you can email us a question at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That email address is also where you can send every story ever lists, panel president lists, listener comments, and other stuff. Be sure to check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can read show notes, download the show, stream the show, and read show notes. Check us out on iTunes. If you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes. The more reviews we get, the more we are featured there, which is good. Now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. For me, all you have to do is go to about.me/MattDWilson, and you will find links to all my stuff. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
Everybody can find links to everything at about.me/ChrisSims. You'll find links there to Twitter, Tumblr, my website, and Comixology, where you can now go buy Dracula the Unconquered #3. It is out. It came out. It is for real. And that's very exciting. Also, the X-Men 92 paperback, Volume 0, that's the Secret Wars miniseries, is coming out in March. And the ongoing series starts in March as well. As soon as I have the FOC dates for everybody, I will let you know. But you can go ahead and tell your local store that you would like to read those, if you would like to read them. Pre-ordering really helps a lot. As you know, we talk about it a lot on this show. So if you feel like reading those books, you can pre-order them from your local shop, or catch them on Comixology if you don't have a local shop. But if you do have a good local store, try and support them if you can. That's it for this week. This has been War Rocket Ajax #290. We will be back next week with another show. So have a great week, everybody.
Yeah! Flash. From this day on, at every greed of money.
Can I point out how beautifully unintentionally you're punning it up in this interview, because you just said that Kamen Rider is a common character, which...
What? Oh no! This is awful. This must stop immediately.
No, I say more. Let's get more.